Accession number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, Reel 8.
Mr. T. Temple, Reel 8. As a stretcher bearer, Mr. Temple, what was really expected of you in a frontline situation?
We were, as I said, I think I've mentioned previously that the condition that we were living in at the time, but the stretcher bearer situation was one, I suppose, which you've got to experience in order to be able to do something about it, or tell so, or say something about it. We were expected to be able to answer any call for assistance, medical or wounded, or of any type at all. There was no need for any authority, for instance, no company commander or platoon commander or section commander or platoon sergeant would ever override us in anything. We were our own bosses in the respect. If we were required, say, at an advanced position, we were called for, we would go to that advanced position. At least two of us would go, with a stretcher and with our equipment. Would leave two behind just in case of other calls. So it could be that you would have to go to a forward section, because bearing in mind that the company aid post was slightly behind, it was in what we call platoon HQ or company headquarters, so that at least you were in the centre of things with the company commander. And anything that was going wrong, you immediately got through the field telephone, so it was go so and so and so and so and there, wherever it was, so we had to go to it. This situation would be, of course, in the more serious wounded, the what we used to call walking wounded, if you just maybe a bullet in the leg or a shrapnel in the shoulder or in the arm or a finger or a foot. If he was able to walk back, there we used to send him back, go to the regiment aid post or at the company aid post, so it was well known then. And this was the our responsibility. We had to go forward in the serious cases or they could come to us. But 9 times out of 10, you are having to go out to it. Now, it might be out in the field, it might be away from the trenches altogether. As I say, in the case of a mine going up, you've got to go out and see what it is, and you've got to go into that minefield. And you're going into that minefield knowing what you're going into. And the poor bloke who was lying out there didn't know what he was going into. And here, I think, is a subtle difference. You go into the man goes out and goes into where no angels fear to tread. But we knew where the angels had gone, knew what had happened. We had to go in after him. So there was that constant danger was always with you of that sort of thing happening, or even some of the enemy taking a pot shot at you, which they often did. We lost quite a number of stretcher bearers in that respect. But that was our responsibility to go wherever that aid was needed, doesn't matter however slight or however serious. That was our job, either go in advance of the company or even to the rear, where perhaps some shelling was happened. If there's something happened, even it might not be one of our company. It might be a complete stranger, another regiment. You still had to go and fix that bloke up. Wherever it was needed, however we were called, that was our job to get there. And invariably, we always did.
Whilst you were in Merseymetoo, what were your actual living conditions like?
Where you slept much the same as what... The best I can describe it is how it was when I joined the fire brigade when I came out of the army. And we used to be ready at night, what we used to call dressed boots, boots on. You went to sleep with fully clothed and with your boots off, as it were. That's the only thing that you would take off. And even that depended on the sort of situation that you were in. If you were in a situation like Tobruk, for instance, where you were completely surrounded by the enemy, you were fully clothed the whole time. But in a place like Matru, where, as I say, it was like the phony war, maybe you could take your boots and trousers off, especially the stretcher bearer, the palatial place that we had to sleep in, because we were sleeping on a stretcher in there, which wasn't being used. And we were more comfortable compared to the riflemen that were in the company. And we used to use those, but normally it was rest boots off, fully clothed boots off. But that depended on the situation. As I said, when you were placed like Tobruk, or even if you were in advance, you were fully clothed and fully dressed the whole time. and you're sometimes lying there with your equipment on if you're in an advance or if you're retiring.
What were you doing for latrines?
You went out in the minefield, if necessary. You took a spade with you. This is what happened there. You just took a shovel with you, or somebody didn't even bother. The most important thing was a piece of paper, I suppose, and that was it. But certainly it was never done within the lines. That was taboo, as far as we were concerned. Otherwise, the place would have been stinking in the crack. And if a bloke went to a minefield, tough shit.
For things that we take for granted, of course, for paper, for them, where did you get them from? Were you issued with toilet rolls when you
came? The company come supply. This is a job I done later on, again as a stretcher bearer, employed by B Echelon, when I had to go to B Echelon to be a stretcher bearer to the supply unit, organised by the quartermaster sergeant and the regimental quartermaster sergeant. I got a job there as ammunition and rationing CO. But this is all it used to be, that the companies would indent for all the necessaries to, as our QM was with John Bush, send it back to his clerks and they would pick it up. And then our quartermaster sergeant would go through and pick it up. Whatever was required, toilet paper and... the only thing that they didn't deal with, of course, was my requirements, which I used to get personally from the main regimental aid post at B Echelon. But this was how it supplies toilet paper. The food was simple fare. Tin bacon, tin sausages, tin potatoes, hardtack biscuits. Bread was never even thought of. I mean, you never dreamt of getting bread at all. And this was basically a diet with your tea in bulk, your powdered sugar in bulk, and your sugar in bulk, cocoa. That was done in bulk in large bags that was carried by the cooking fraternity, as it were.
How did you get this food? Did someone cook it for you, or did you group together and cook your own?
Again, this is one of the things possibly I should have explained earlier on. Once you're prepared for war, what you used to do in civil life was again transformed. So you had a cookhouse, which used to in civil, prior to any war, would have a huge dining hall and all the cooks were employed in that one particular kitchen. Here they were split up like the stretcher bearers and go to companies. And then again, if a platoon had to go out somewhere to do a long desert patrol, they would take a cook with them with all the necessary stuff in a 1500 weight truck with all these provisions and that. So it was much the same as a stretcher bearer, who were split up into fours to go to companies. They were split up into twos. I think it was two, to, and all the necessary company on a 1500 weight truck. That was more or less like Wagon's Hoe. we used to brew up quite frequently, and we used to have our supplies of petrol sent up in these wonderful silver tins, about 8 gallon, 6 gallon in a tin, quite tall. It was about 18 inches tall and about a foot square. And we used to just cut them in half and fill it, three-quarter fill it with sand, and then just soak it with petrol, and that was your fire. That was to do all your cooking on. The companies had much, much better ones, of course. When you were with a company, they would have these, again, petrol burners, but they were force-fed, and they had these racks, metal racks, which extended to anything up to 10 racks, and this petrol thing would just shoot. You had a block in the end off, of course. Your sides were blocked, and the end was blocked off, and this petrol jet used to just come up and heat your Dixie, so your big cooking pans. But when we didn't have that, as a platoon or a section that you were going up, we just used these old petrol tins, soaked in petrol, and just blew up on those. But the fare, as I say, was very stodgy, very staid, never any variety. I think one of the things that was a McConic is some sort of tinned stew, and then we had these tinned bacon, which we never opened before we cooked. We just used to put a Dixie on the fire and put the tins of sausage or bacon inside there with punctured, and just wait until they boiled up and brewed up and then opened up as a heater. We had no facilities of frying, no eggs or thing, no eggs and bacon, and no bread. You just had the hardtack biscuits, as I say, with this piece of bacon on a piece of sausage. And it did at lunchtime, it was probably your dinner time, if you got dinner, was possibly one of these tins of stew of McConaughey's, whatever they called it. And it wasn't till later in the war when they brought out these K-rations, not the K-rations, it was American-type K-rations, but They'd done ours compo rations, we called ours, and it was done in a big box. And it was always based on a section of seven men for 14 days, or two sections for 7 days, you know, whatever, one day for 7 days. And we used to work it out there. That was a great variety, but we never saw those at all in the desert until after Alamein, when we realised the First Army were getting these things, and the Eighth Army were still getting the heart attack and biscuits. We thought very disgustingly ploughed all the way through there and, on this hard tartan biscuits. It wasn't. We actually had a good cook, a young lad called Halford. He was prepared to try, and he used to say sausages, for instance, he used to make them. And he used to say, soak the biscuits, the hard tartan biscuits overnight to make them soft into a puddingy mass, and then he would mince the sausage meat up and put salt and pepper in it to make it peppery, and he would form his own little sausages to heat in a pan. With some bacon fat that he kept out of the bacon, and it was quite tasty. It was quite tasty. Porridge, of course, was always a good standby for the light meal, light weight, quickness, speed meal really. And I often used to think of the speed meals that they've got today, as opposed to what the stuff that we had then. Same thing, I suppose, but maybe we were the start of all this. So I don't know.
How many meals a day were you likely to get?
In a static position, such as Mersey Matru or Tobruk. Not so much Tobruk, but Mersey Matru, which was very, very static. Usual three meals a day. You get your breakfast, whatever it was, and your lunch and a bite to eat with a cup of cocoa at supper time. Maybe, again, a hardtack biscuit with it, but you wouldn't get anything very much. We were all very lean and very fit. You had to be, you know, to survive, as it were, the desert.
Were you in a situation having your stand twos and your stand downs?
Oh, yes. An hour before dawn, we always used to stand two, the whole company, didn't matter what your job was, you always stand two. We would get our equipment on, and they all have a sack with the field dressings in, and the ointments and the tinctures and the iodines. And that was about an hour before dawn, every morning without fail. And then it wasn't stand down until it was possibly an hour after daylight. And then they would make sure that there was nothing lurking out there, and then start breakfast. So that happened every day. And you always had sentries out, of course, every night. We used to take our part. Our part of our job was doing sentry going up with the riflemen. As I say, you were split up into a company, and a company was split up into three platoons, and your three platoons were split up into sections. But each section had his own. Suppose seven men in a section, he would have to do his stint maybe an hour. So you were just waking each other up, and you're only getting about 6 hours sleep. I say stand down. My stand down, and he stood down up at night, stood out the two at night. When it was going to get dark, but darkness falls so quickly. It was like pulling the curtain down, you know. So you see the sun 1 minute, the next minute it's just gone. And it was that particular time that we used to have to stand to, just before the sun actually descended. And until half an hour, and then you start your sentry go. Once you stand two period, your sentry go started from then until you were satisfied the next morning that everything was okay. How they split it up was entirely up to them. As I say, usually it was about an hour at a time. And your rota was strictly kept on that basis, so that you started at the top of this and finished at the bottom, because in some cases a lad would do two stints. So if you kept that rota going the whole time, well, everybody was getting his fair share of wakeful hours. And the platoon sergeant and corporal would always, one of them was always in charge. He would be always going out to the sentries to make sure that he was there.
Sure, we know one about 18 at this time, were you 18, 19?
Well, I was under 18 at the time, Harry, as a matter of fact, and during one of the air raids, one of the lads, who was about 16 or 17, he was very severely injured, ringing Richardson from Newcastle. And it was at that time that the colonel shouldn't have allowed us up there. We were underage before, because it was specifically then at 18, you had to be 18. And as you're looking at the days, the Gulf War, for instance, the lads were 17 in there. I don't know if the King's regulations have changed at all, but certainly it was 18 for us. And there was nine of us sent back from the regiment to go back to Cairo. We were under the command then of the reserve company, the Coldstream Guards, and we were sent back to the Citadel in Cairo. No, in Alexandra. No, it was then we were the we were shipped then back to Cairo, and then we went out to the Muasca. But we were sent back because of the injury to this lad. If it hadn't been any injury to any of the lads, you see, well, I can't count for this. When he was shipped back, of course, and realised what his age was, I thought the senior medical officer set the ball in motion, and I think it was about 3 weeks later that we were sent back from Mesometru. But I rejoined the battalion shortly after that. I mean, it was almost 18 at the time, but we had quite a session.
So they were still at Mesometru when you went back to them?
Yeah, there was still, there was, I think, four of us went back together. The four senior ones went back together. And it's funny, you see, there's again that we were in charge of this company aid post, as it were, underage. Well, we were telling all these fellas what to do. They didn't like it, but that was the position. You were not an NCO at all. There was no such thing, because they wouldn't promote you just to be in charge of four stretcher or three stretcher bearers.
So how long were you out, do you recall?
Away
from the battalion?
We went back, I think it was about the July. And the July in 40, and we went back, and I didn't come back until September. So about 2 months, I would think.
The 2 months or so that you were back in the canal area, well, what were you doing?
Well, basically nothing. We were actually training with the reserve company of the 3rd Battalion Coldstreams. We went back to Alexander first with them, and then they were shipped back to Cairo in the Citadel. And we just should train with them. Their medical officer would do very much the same as what we were doing there. We would drill. But our drill, the light infantry drill, is totally different from the guards' drill. So we told the drill sergeant then was from the Coldstream, was Scabby Rowlands. He was a scab too. But when he found out that our drill was totally different, he just gave us a different guards' drill at all, completely different. And our pace was different. When he used to tell us to quick march, and we were going 160 minutes, they were going 120. Well, ours was a much shorter pace, but of course he just gave us up as a bad job at the finish, because we were just carrying on our same way. We said, oh, forget about it, don't do any drill. Well, we weren't doing any rifle drill at all, under 18. And we were doing medical and just scrounging around jelly, going up in the town in Cairo, and I was looking around. Until we were shifted to, was then decided by the hierarchy, the top dogs, that they wanted to have a proper base depot formed in the canal zone. So we went down and went to a place called El Casasin, right next to where the Italian internees were. Out it was in the desert, but just away from Bitter Lakes, you know. And they were in an ideal position when we put them in this prison camp that would have been formed. But they found this place. It was an open area inside an escarpment, which was impenetrable. You couldn't have climbed it if you tried. It was so steep, and it came right away around in a rather an orange shaped circle, and there was a gap between what we call the big flea and the little flea, and they just closed it off, and it was perfect. And they had the shanty around the top rather than low down. It was perfect for the position that we're in, and we went in that area to formulate the original base depot. This is where it all started, when they decided that we're going to have a base depot. And it was started by us, the Coldstreams, and our small detachment of boys, putting up tents, until the next time I saw that place would be during the Libyan campaign, the Lebanon campaign, because remember, during that particular time, the French were in occupying both Syria and the Lebanon. And it was during that campaign that I was shipped back to hospital. And that the next time I was coming out of hospital, instead of going back to the regiment, you went back to the base depot. It all changed, and they got proper buildings up and hospitals, guard rooms, and, you know. We were still on the canvas. The main body was still on the canvas. But this is where it was informed by us. It was a complete change from the time that we started off to the time when I revisited a couple of years later.
You mentioned going into the town, Cairo, for leisure. What were your impressions of the Egyptians and Egypt?
I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. There was always, after the first book, they would do you down just as soon as look at you. And we were always warned by the army authorities to particularly watch your paybooks. Because we didn't have passports. You just had your army paybook, which is your identification, which you had to carry with you at all times. They were always getting those because they could flog them. To who, I don't know, but I'm assuming that to either the Germans or the Italians to be used as a British soldier. To the good speakers. Although, when we talked about that time, we were getting a lot of support from South Africa, Rhodesia. We got troops from Rhodesia. The South Africans had their own units, of course, but Rhodesia didn't. They weren't big enough to have reinforcements, so they farmed theirs out to the various regiments that were out in the desert. And we got quite a number from various towns in Rhodesia. The Senegalese, they had a detachment, the Camel Corps had a detachment. You had all nationalities in a hub around this base depot eventually. That you didn't know who the hell you were talking to, you know. And all different nationalities. As I said, this is what the Egyptians used to do with it if they found you in the muggy for your pay book or anything else they could find on you. I didn't like them, I'll be honest, I really didn't like them. They were always on, as I say, always on the make, always ready for a fast buck, always ready to do you down. Even the taxis or the garries that we used to ride in, they would try to charge you over the top. But we were a bit wise from them. You know.
What did you do for leisure in the towns?
Much the same as well. At that time, we reached a stage in life where we were allowed to drink. You know, we weren't 18, but people used to just, in fact, they didn't know us. We looked that age. We used to go out for a drink in the cabarets, the various bars, go to the cinema. There was no such thing as dances at all. The naffies were there. It was quite reasonable, really, quite reasonable. The entertainment was quite good.
So. When you went back up to rejoin the battalion, and of course you were there before, for some time before, did you have any forms of leisure in the time that you were there?
What, in the desert?
In Mesmer
in Mesmer, none at all. Nothing there. You see, you couldn't, Harry, because your regiment was split up into, it could be anything up to a couple of miles. In defensive positions, because you were in the forward position. The only thing that was about you was your reserve company. Bear in mind, you had four companies. There was always one in reserve. And the other three companies were split up right across the front that you were responsible for. And your reserve company was there in case you were in any difficulties, and they would dispatch their troops to wherever it was needed. Much the same as a brigademan goes into action. They always have a reserve regiment to come in. But there was no entertainment. When the regiment or the battalion got together, that was a different kettle of fish. Those of amongst us who could, knew a bit of music, knew a little bit about entertainment, would always organise concert parties. We used to have some great concert parties, especially when we got into Malta, where we were all together. We had some wonderful times organising concert parties and things like that, amongst the women, getting blokes dressed up as women and putting concert little bits of shows on. You know, we used to do quite well. But at Mersey Metro, where you were dispersed in places like that in Tibrook, where we just wasn't on, or even during Wavell's push, you were advancing the whole time. You didn't have time for anything like that. But when the battalion was together, certainly we used to make our own entertainment. There was no such thing as censor in those days. You saw no entertainment at all. You got no entertainment until you got a leave from the desert. And that was when the lads used to let their hair down.
When did you move from Mersey Metro?
We actually moved from Mersey Metro when, during the course of Wavell's push, I think it was towards the end of November 1940, and then we started advancing with the it wasn't the 8th Army then, it was the 30th Corps really, that was we were advancing with. We weren't big enough to be an army. We had, I think two battalions of tanks, which was again at the tank corps. I think it was the 2nd and 4th Battalion tanks, the 7th Hussars. The 11th Hussars formed the armoured part of the division of the army, or the corps, and there was the KRRs, the Rifle Brigade, and the Durhams, and the Bergen Hearts formed the infantry. And one of the results of Wavell's push, actually, when we made it, we went out from Barani, we just walked through Barani, no question about it. Even Saloum, when we had to go up Halfar Pass and the Saloum Pass, we went roundabout. We came up, you know, through the desert from City Barani. We went right away around, so that we cut them off from the top. And one of our responsibilities were to put wooden tanks up, and we were given a battery of 25-pounders, and our trucks, just before dawn, would start making this huge cloud, and these tanks would appear as if they were advancing on a position, and then the 25-pounders would open up, and our mortars in an advanced position would start opening up on their positions. And they would send their troops round, and this is how they got through Tobruk, as easy as walking through it. really. Siloam was the first one we realised what these tactics could do. It was only on a trial basis. I mean, we sent one bloke out and said, there's some Italian somewhere down there, down by the sea, see what he can do. Charlie Blackmore, and a mate of mine went out with another couple of blokes, and they caught with this huge cave, and he just threw two grenades in there. And there was 500 Italians came out. He's just embossing them back. You know, it was as simple as that. And this went right the way through. We just sailed through all the towns, Derna, Tobruk, Bardia, sailed through them all, just on the same... They never twigged it. They didn't come out to find out. So we got away with it the whole time. In fact, it didn't take all our battalion to do it. It just the best part of the battalion were following up, as it were, salvaging all the stuff that the Italians were just leaving behind, and they were coming in the thousands.
What was your involvement in this? What are your experiences?
I was with one of the salvage companies at the time, Air Company, I think it was. I think I was with Air Company. You used to alternate. You would do one job one day and the next day. Sometimes you'd go into the desert on reconnaissance and come back in and see what was what, you know, and make yourself a nuisance at the back and come back again. And you would go on these salvage work. A lot of them that used to follow up behind was some Jewish troops, incidentally, because they had stopped their troubles in Palestine during the course of this the war. We had no problem with them during the war. And they would help us with the salvage. That's all they would do, mind. And they wouldn't go up fighting anything like that.
What kind of things were you picking up?
Oh, dozens and dozens of small arms. Well, I say dozens. You were picking up hundreds of boxes of ammunition, mortars. Their type was almost like our 303, but it wasn't quite 303, so we couldn't use it. We were capturing their light machine guns, the Breeder, mortars, even trucks. I mean, you're talking about these big diesels that they had, you know, huge hogsheads of wine as they had with it. You picked up anything, you just stacked it in a whole heap waiting for these fellas to come up behind you and say, right, oh, we'll take some of that, and using their transport to ship it all back. Anything that we found useful, such as, well, when we were in Tobruk, we had a lot of Italian ammunition and Italian Breeders, which were more or less very much like old Bren, but you couldn't swap the ammunition with them. So we had to, if we got their ammunition, we had to use their guns and the ammunition. And this is all we were doing, that, and plus the fact you're just going into the desert or doing the duty with the wooden tanks and canvas tanks, as it were. This went through, and it was, casualties were very, very light. The tanks, I suppose, were the tanks, not the crews, were the biggest bugbear, because you were so far away from your base. Well, let's face it, you reached Benghazi, a place called Bidafont, the other side of Benghazi, and they finished it with just half a dozen tanks left. And you see, you weren't getting reinforcements. This was the worst thing that they ever done with that desert force. If they'd given them the stuff at the time and sent the real stuff out, they would remember that Wavell had about five different theatres of war to fight. And if they just said, right, look, we'll concentrate on one and then get the others, we could have gone through right away through to Tunisia. The Boers were different. And for now that the French had packed up, we could have gone right away through. But you see, they didn't do that. He was having to supplement other theatres of war. When we had the success here at the other side of Bidafont, they would start withdrawing troops and saying, right, you're going into Greece, you're going to Eritrea. My brother was in Eritrea. He was in the artillery. He came from India, and they were the 4th Indian Div. And then they had me and two uncles with the 50th Division. They were further back altogether in Iran and Iraq, because we held those places as well, you know, Harry. When I think of what this country had hold of during the course of the war, I wonder that they really didn't supply us with everything that we wanted and better stuff, because, you know, even when we were fighting the Germans, we were going up the desert and they were chasing us. We were preferred, you know, chasing the Italians up, the Germans were chasing us back again, backwards and forwards, not knowing. It was so a state of flux, really. You didn't know what to do. We used to come to the waterhole and say, bloody hell, the Germans have bloody well probably poisoned this waterhole. Stinks of oil, they poured oil down it. Wasn't it bloody all seeping through, wasn't it? Anyway, look at the oil fields that Libya's got now, which only protruded during the course of the war and after the war, and the same as Iran and Iraq, and we had control of those. We had control of Syria and the Lebanon. Why?
How far did you get?
As far, just this side of Benghazi. And then, as I say, we were shipped back. We were in, well, morally, the morale was great, because we just, you know, defeated the bloody army, as it were, and took hundreds of thousands of prisoners, and hundreds of thousands of tons of equipment. I mean, as an army, it just didn't exist, and I think this was the mistake that they made, instead of keeping our army out there, in case of any threat from the Germans, which they obviously didn't anticipate at the time. They never thought that he was going to come across the border.
So you came back?
We came back to being reinforced and have a bit of leave, and, you know, we came back to, again, the base depot of Cossasin.
But what time would this be?
Oh, this should be after the Pull Wave was pushed. That would be 1941. There'd be sometime around about 1941, around about the June area, June time. So we'd spent quite a bit of time up in the desert, backwards and forwards, and travelling about.